Welcome to another edition of Northwestern Outdoors Radio, the weekly show covering the great outdoors in the Pacific Northwest and Rocky Mountain West. Fishing, hunting, conservation, recreation, and destinations, we cover that and more. Northwestern Outdoors is brought to you by Max Lurk, Sportsman's Warehouse, Northeast Montana's Missouri River Country, the Wallowa County Chamber of Commerce, and the Northern Pike Minnow Sport Reward Fishery Program. Now, let's see what's in store this week. Here's your host, John Cruz.
Welcome to the show. I've got to tell you on a personal note, things are starting to look up with my wounded knee. I've got the leg brace off, more or less, unless I'm walking over uneven terrain or maybe going fishing on a bass boat, which is exactly what I did last week. And of course, my best friend Rusty Johnson and I, the original Northwestern Outdoors pro staffer, decided to pick a horrible day weather-wise to go fishing. Now, 2 days before, the day we went fishing was a Tuesday, and it was 72 degrees here in the Columbia Basin. Absolutely beautiful out. Fast forward 2 days, the temperature dropped to 42 degrees. The wind was blowing about 5 miles an hour, and with the wind chill, it was a frigid 36 degrees and raining consistently. How's that sound for a fun day on the water bass fishing? Now, I've got to tell you, Rusty and I, we, pardon the phrase, suck at fishing for bass when it comes to cold fronts. We've tried it many times, usually during bass tournaments in April. It seems we always seem to be fishing a cold front that's passing through, and we've had very little success doing so. Never caught a 5-fish limit before, and things were looking that way. We were cold. We were getting soaked, even with our rain gear. But after about 2.5 hours, Rusty managed to haul in a nice 3.5-pound largemouth bass, and then we began to pattern them using soft plastic unweighted worms called Senkos and weighted jigs with plastic crawfish trailers. I picked up a 2.5-pound bass and followed that up with a 4.1-pound bass. That was a nice one. As a matter of fact, bigger than any I've caught out of Potholes Reservoir in a couple of years, and finished things up with a bass that was about 1.5 pounds. We ended up getting 9 bites over the course of about 6.5 hours, which doesn't sound great, but it's better than we've ever done before fishing in these conditions. So we were pleased. Probably would have brought about a 13.5-pound bag to the scale and then released those fish, which wouldn't have won us anything, but at least it was respectable. And it's always good to start off as a respectable competitor when it comes to tournament fishing. This week on the show, we've got some great guests for you. One of them is Bob Loomis. He'll be here for an extended Max Minute because in Washington State, the Lowland Lakes Opener is coming up later this month. And he's got some tips that'll help you catch more of those hatchery trout being stocked into hundreds of lakes in the Evergreen State. Staying in Washington, we're going to talk to Terry Wildy. She's with the National Park Service because Mount Rainier National Park, well, it's getting so much visitation during the summer months that folks are having to wait up to 2 hours in line before they can get in the park. So they are now mandating reservations for the months of July and August, and she'll tell you more about that and how you can still visit the park in a more spontaneous manner than making your reservations now. Danielle Euler with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks will talk to you about bear safety, whether you are camping, whether you're at home, or whether you're maybe fishing or bicycling or trail running. She's got a lot of tips that'll help you keep safe in bear country. And in just a minute, we'll talk to Gary Lewis about hunter ethics. We tend to think here in North America that it's a constant, but in certain places of the world, our ethics don't quite match up to other ethics, and we have to be open about that. Throw in your Sportsman's Warehouse trivia question of the week, and as always, we've got a great show coming your way, so let's get it started right now with another edition of Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. There's no other sound along a stream or waterway quite like the reverberating metallic call of a belted kingfisher. As the showy crested kingfisher flies overhead, strong staccato wing beats and white wing patches flash a Morse code pattern. The bird's power is in its large head and sharp bill. The king of fishers hovers over water, then dives headfirst to catch its prey in its bill. Emerging from the water, the bird flies back to a perch. There it juggles the meal, usually a fish, frog, or crawdad, into position and gulps it down. At this time of year, The best places to see belted kingfishers are along sandy banks, where they're busy digging nesting burrows. These stocky, short-legged birds use their front claws, with two forward-pointing toes fused together for added strength, and their strong bills to dig holes. The holes typically reach 3 to 6 feet into the sandy bank, but some nesting holes can extend 15 feet. When not perching, fishing, or building a nesting burrow, the belted kingfisher dashes through the air, warning intruders with its rapid-fire call. You, too, can dig deeper and see a photo when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote is provided by the Bobolink Foundation and generous listeners around the world.
Hunt of a Lifetime is a nationwide nonprofit organization dedicated to providing hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under who suffer from life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. These adventures make big differences in the lives of those who participate in them, and in many cases are literally a dream come true that brings hope and therapy to their lives. Find out more, get involved, or donate today at huntofalifetime.org. That's huntofalifetime.org. huntofalifetime.org.
Next up on Northwestern Outdoors Radio, we've got the very well-known outdoors and television personality, Gary Lewis, on the line, coming at us from Central Oregon. Gary, great to have you back on the show.
John, it's always good to talk to you.
You know, we were talking the other day, and the topic of hunter ethics came up and how it's not a universal. Now, here in North America, if you shoot a big game animal like an elk or a deer, you're expected to take the meat home. And that's why most of us are hunting these animals anyway. But it's not always true in other parts of the world. A friend of mine who hunts all over the world went on a multi-species trip to Mongolia. And one of the species he hunted was an elk. And he got a 5x5 elk. And they cut off the head, and they left the entire body and all the meat to waste because they preferred to eat goat there, and they had no interest in eating venison. And that was just a real shocker to me.
Isn't it crazy? You know, we grew up in this North American model of wildlife conservation that works pretty well here, and you know, we're proud of it, and we pat ourselves on the back when we eat the last, you know, fork of elk meat and hope, you know, that we get another one. But that's our ethic. And other people from other cultures have different ethics. And so when people move here, like they come across the southern border, you know, they don't have our ethic. They come here from Russia. They don't have our ethic. We shouldn't expect them to because they weren't raised that way. When we go to New Zealand, they have an ethic there that protects the ground cover, the plants. And all the big game species there were introduced. So a lot of people in New Zealand consider those invasive species. And the more important thing to protect is the species of ground cover.
That's really interesting to me. And so you were telling me that in this case in New Zealand, because they want to protect the ground cover, that they'll shoot the deer there. And just like in Mongolia, they aren't necessarily interested in eating the venison.
Right. So in New Zealand, on the South Island, if you have a piece of property and the government says that you have too many goats or there's too many deer on your property, they'll send you a letter. And they'll say, well, you must remove X amount of animals. And so let's just say the number is 80, and you're supposed to remove 80 animals. You've got a certain amount of time to accomplish that. And if you don't, the government will send a helicopter with a shooter that will shoot those animals, and they'll leave them lay just like, you know, the landowner probably will leave them lay.
While this happens, you know, in other countries around the world who, again, don't have the North American model of conservation, there is one instance here in America that I can think of where, you know, the animals aren't necessarily harvested for either their meat or their fur. That would be coyotes. You know, back when you and I were growing up, there were a lot of people that were still trapping coyotes. Number one, you know, they're a threat to livestock. And number two, their fur was worth something. not so much these days. So a lot of folks, I'm assuming, when they shoot coyotes, they're letting them lie, aren't they?
Yeah, that's one way you can deal with them. Or you can skin that coyote out and take it to a taxidermist. Or you can make friends with a trapper. There's still value in those furs. You know, not as much as there was, but you could take that fresh coyote to a trapper and give it to him and let him do something with it. What I do is I'll take that coyote to my friend, you know, taxidermist friend, and then he skins it out. That's what he's doing every day. And then he'll sell that fur to somebody who'll use it for a decoration, you know, a throw rug on the back of a couch or something like that. So there still is something you can do with those coyotes. And if you shoot the coyote and you leave it lay, well, you're not getting any shade from me.
Well, and a lot of ranchers would agree with you on that one. Let's go ahead and turn the topic to something else. You and our mutual friend Troy Rodakowski, an outdoors writer from Junction City, Oregon, have come up with something pretty special for folks that want to attract deer or elk or turkey to their properties. Tell us about your wildlife forage.
Okay, so it's a blend that has, you know, three different ingredients in it that if you plant this, the deer, the elk, the turkeys, they're going to find it and they're going to camp out on it. And at least that's what happened when I tried it the first time. I lived in town. I had a little piece of ground the deer would come to, and this one big buck, he bedded down in that little food plot that I had in town, and he wouldn't let any other deer on it until he had eaten his share. He was there for like 5 days.
So what kind of food is in this wildlife forage that you're selling?
Okay, so it's clover, brassica, it's winter wheat, and these are things that components we might be able to change too, and so let people do a custom blend. You know, we can do that as well. But we sell a bag, $44.95 plus shipping, and it'll treat up to 1.5 acres of ground. This is a good time to get it in the ground, especially if you're anticipating rains in the next month, or you can get some irrigation water on it. And if you've got good soil, this stuff is going to come right up. If you've got bad soil like I do, you're going to want to get some water in and try and get it a quarter inch, you know, under the soil, and it'll take off.
Is this formulated for here in the Northwest? I mean, would this work like in Missouri or Michigan or New York? Or is it, you know, specifically for the animals that are here based on the forage that you have?
This is something that Troy and Bailey Seed have put together that works wherever you plant it. You know, we are particularly interested in black-tailed deer and wild turkeys and Roosevelt elk and Rocky Mountain elk. It'll work wherever you plant it and wherever there's good soil and water.
So how do folks buy the wildlife forage that you and Troy have come out with?
You can go to my website, GaryLewisOutdoors.com, click on the store and click on wildlife forage, and it'll take you right to the page that tells about it. And then send me an email. That's probably the best way. GaryLewisOutdoors@gmail.com.
All right. So email Gary at GaryLewisOutdoors@gmail.com. Check out the information about the wildlife forage at GaryLewisOutdoors.com. And you can also find out about the books that Gary has written and find out when his television show, Frontiers Unlimited, airs. And take in everything that Gary has to offer. But this wildlife forage base, if you own property in a rural area, this sounds like a great opportunity to get more wildlife, whether it be deer or elk or turkey, on your land. And if you're a hunter, that's something you definitely want to do. Gary, always a pleasure, sir, to have you on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Hey, always love talking to you, John, and hearing you on the radio, too.
In other news, I ran across Russ Baker the other day at Mardon Resort. He had just finished pre-fishing for a American Bass Association tournament with his partner, Rich Kraft, and they had one heck of a day on the water, catching about 25 bass. As a matter of fact, Rich caught one that was nearly 6 pounds. There's some big ones out there, and that's a good thing, because Russ has got a couple of tournaments coming up in the next couple of weeks, and the deadline to register for both of them is April 21st. The first is the Pro-Am tournament, taking place April 24th and 25th. The pro is the person who has the boat. The amateur is the person that fishes out of the back of the boat. And if you've never fished a bass tournament before, I'd really recommend doing this. Or if you're not familiar with Potholes Reservoir, fish as an amateur. And there's plenty of room still for the pros too. And there's a big payout for the winners. Speaking of big payouts, the big bass tournaments taking place May 4th and 5th, there's going to be hourly cash prizes, and if we have a 100-boat field, the person who catches the biggest bass of the weekend is going to get a $10,000 check. You can find out more and register today at BigBassTrail.com. That's BigBassTrail.com. Go ahead and register. It's going to be fun, and I'll see you there.
Anglers are getting a raise this year with the Northern Pike Minnow Sport Reward Fishery Program, and the fish are biting. Here's how it works. First, register at a pike minnow station along the Columbia or Snake River. Next, go fishing for pike minnow and bring back all of them that measure 9 inches or longer. The fish are worth $6, $8, or $10, and the more fish you catch, the more each one is worth. Keep an eye out for tagged fish, too, because those are worth $500. Go fishing, make money, and have fun. Find out more at pikeminnow.org. Welcome back to Northwestern Outdoors Radio and to an extended Max Minute brought to you by Max Lure.
You know what time it is? It's time for another extended Max Minute. And with us again is Bob Lewis from Max Lure. Bob, always great to have you back on the air.
Well, thank you very much, John.
So, we've got the Lowland Lakes opener coming up in Washington State. A lot of folks going to be out trying to catch trout, both from the boat and from the bank. I got to ask you, what are your favorite lakes to fish when the Lowland Lakes opener happens?
You know, John, just obviously the easy ones right here in our backyard. We've got Wapato Lake, Conconelli, which is a fantastic fishery. You've also got the Big Twin, Little Twin Lakes up around Winthrop area. I mean, there's a number of really good ones around here.
Well, I know I've got some neighbors that always love to go fish Big and Little Twin Lakes up there by Winthrop. Wapato Lake, always a good bet as well, and one of the better success rates year in, year out. And Conconelli, I got to love that town. I mean, number one, you get to go fish, and then you get to go hang out the Sitting Bull, and you can sit and bull all day long, and then go outside and watch the deer and watch the turkeys, which are more numerous than the people in town.
Yep.
So how are we going to catch them? We'll start off from the boat.
Trolling applications, you know, for trout, there's a number of things you can do. I'm going to start out with a sling blade and a peewee wiggle hoochie is what I'm going to start out with trolling. You know, you get a lot of movement off the sling blade. You're trolling faster because you're trolling for trout. And a peewee wiggle hoochie obviously gets a lot of movement with the wiggle hoochie bill. And I'll tip it with a little bit of bait.
Let's say you're fishing for shore, maybe at Liar's Cove Resort. What are you going to go ahead and use?
Well, I'm going to pick out your number one favorite, Promise Keeper.
Absolutely.
Promise Keeper, you know, it's a spinner that is designed as a wedding ring, and it's a leaded spinner, and we make them in 16th ounce, 8th ounce, and quarter ounce, and it works fantastic, and it has a smile blade on it. So I'll go to a Promise Keeper, or I'm going to go to a Crip Lure.
Well, not only that, if you're fishing up at Conconelli, you got a good chance of reeling in not just trout, but also kokanee or smallmouth bass. So lots of reasons to fish our Lowland Lakes. It's coming up quick, so don't miss out. And if you need some great tackle, you just need to go to maxlure.com or go to a sporting goods store near you. Get what you need for success for the Lowland Lakes opener. Always a pleasure, Bobby.
Thank you, John.
Are you looking for a game changer to help you catch more trout, kokanee, and salmon? No problem. Just tie on Max Crip Lure. Cast it or troll it. Either way, its specially designed ring chamber emits a low-frequency vibration with its erratic movement. It will catch more fish and make them strike. Better still, the different colors for the lure can be matched to just about any fishery. Look for the Crip Lure from Max Lure Company at a sporting goods store near you or go online at maxlure.com.
The Brewster Salmon Derby is going off August 2nd through the 4th on the Upper Columbia River. There's over $10,000 in cash and prizes to include a $2,000 check for the King of the Pool. Register today at BrewsterSalmonDerby.com.
You're back in with Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. It's spring. That means those bears are coming out of hibernation and they are hungry. That's why we've got Danielle Euler on the line. She's with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. She just gave a presentation about being bear aware this time of year, not only in the country, but also at your home. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
So I want to start off with a situation that happened in Cottage Grove, Oregon recently. A black bear was being fed by an employee at a car dealership in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and became completely habituated to humans, where the bear would just approach humans, expecting to get fed by hand. And as you might imagine, it didn't end up well. This fed bear became a dead bear because it was cornering people and not letting them go where they needed to go, and it was becoming very intimidating. And this is a situation that also played out in Red Lodge last year too, isn't it?
Yeah, and honestly, I would have to defer to our bear manager there in Red Lodge for the specifics on that incident, but I can speak to just the concept that a fed bear is a dead bear and why we say that, even though it seems a bit harsh. When a bear learns to get food from people, and that could be accidental or purposeful, as in it sounds like this case where somebody was feeding the bear, they're just such intelligent animals that once that habit becomes strongly formed, they are very unlikely to go back to eating natural foods or becoming natural in their behavior again. So really, that's a human safety issue at that point. And so I know, at least for us in a lot of our human bear conflicts, the habituation is not always intentional, but people don't necessarily store their garbage or bird feeders properly, and then bears find them, start using them, and then develop a strong habit of returning to that. And then usually at that point, if it's a human safety issue, the bear needs to be euthanized. And I can tell you, it isn't fun for our staff. It's not something anyone likes to do, and it's a very preventable end result. So people can do a lot. I think we forget that, you know, even in towns and rural places, we live in bear country, they live in human country, so to speak, and so we can do a lot to avoid those conflicts in the first place just by making it hard for bears to get to calorie-rich foods like garbage and bird feeders. So those are two of the big ones, I would say.
Right. Pet food is also another one, folks. So again, keep that stuff stored inside, or if you've got garbage, make sure it's in a bear-proof container if you're in bear country. And again, never, ever intentionally feed a bear, because you're literally writing a death sentence for it when you do. Let's go ahead and turn to staying safe in bear country in certain situations. We'll start off with camping. A lot of folks are going to be hitting campsites, both in state parks and in more rural places. What are some things that campers should do to make sure that a bear is not visiting them in the middle of the night?
Oh, absolutely. At this time of year, I'm always thinking, like, got to turn the bear brain back on. Have to start thinking about how to set up a camp in a way that doesn't invite a bear to stay. So what that means is just putting everything that's a possible attractant, which means pet food, our food, drinks. Also, they can smell the food and drinks inside of canned goods or freeze-dried packaging, and keeping those inside of a bear-resistant container when you're not at the campsite or when you're asleep at night. And it depends on your local regulations. I know here in Montana, you can use the inside of a vehicle, too. You can lock your food inside of a vehicle, but I'm not sure if everywhere where your folks are listening, that's something that will work, because some areas have really habituated bears who've learned how to break into cars. So that varies from place to place. One suggestion I would give to your listeners that helps make it easy to put everything away at night is when you're packing for your camping trip, put all the attractants, all the smellies, your toiletries, your food, everything in the same container. And then at night when you need to go put everything away, it's all together and you just throw it in the truck or throw it in the bear-resistant container.
That is very good advice. Now, a lot of folks come to Montana for the fishing because, goodness knows, you've got some great fishing, especially trout fishing there. But sometimes anglers can have conflicts with bears, too. What are some ways that anglers can reduce those conflicts?
Yeah, so anglers are out on the water, and in a few different cases, they can actually have a higher risk of encountering any wildlife, but bears, too. Walking along river corridors and along stream beds and lakes is also the place that a lot of animals like to travel. So you're just more likely to encounter wildlife and bears specifically when you're fishing. And also often the sound of water running or thick willows and brush that might obscure sound a bit make it harder for a bear to hear you coming. So be a little bit louder when you're fishing because you're not going to scare the fish by shouting out, "Hey bear," every once in a while. And then have your bear spray handy and know how to use it. And I would just say for folks wearing waders, that usually is best like on a chest harness up higher out of the water, of course. So those are some suggestions. If you do keep your catch, make sure you're storing all those fish smells at night in a place that bears can't get to them. And I would not wear the same clothes to bed. Not that you would, but I would not wear those same clothes to bed when you're camping.
You know, I also noticed disposing of the fish carcasses. I hadn't thought of this before, and I guess I should have, because I've seen bears working streams during spawning time and getting those spawned out fish. But you suggest cutting fillet fish into smaller pieces that can more easily be carried away in the current, because a lot of times, you know, we'll just take what we want out of the fish and just throw it into the stream right next to the shore and think nothing of it, but that's a bear attractant, isn't it?
Yeah. Fish parts are definitely a bear attractant, so the best thing to do is to get them into faster moving water or away from the shore so that a bear is not drawn to an area where other folks might be fishing and then they're also congregating to get those entrails and parts. So I think that's a good suggestion, cutting out smaller, throwing it into the fast moving water so it can sink. Any air bladders, puncture them so they sink as well. Just making sure that those attractants get into deeper water away from people.
You also recommend storing fish in coolers on ice to get rid of that smell to a certain extent. But not all coolers are the same. Some are bear-proof, some are not. And I've seen videos where bears get into non-bear-proof coolers in a hurry.
Oh, yeah. We strongly recommend, and where it's required, you have to have your bear attractants, including fish fillets or whatever parts of the fish you're keeping, inside of a locked bear-resistant cooler. So the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee has a testing program at the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center in West Yellowstone, and that's how all those products are certified. So if you look on the IGBCOnline.org website, then you'll see a listing of all the certified products. And if you go out and buy one of these, or maybe you already have them, make sure you lock them with a padlock on both corners, or nuts and bolts work great too. I just recommend a regular, not a wing nut, because bears can kind of manipulate that with their claws. They're very, very good at breaking into things. So those would be some suggestions. Yeah, always in a bear-resistant container, especially a cooler.
You know, and the last thing I want to cover is bicycling and running in bear country. We actually had some bicyclists in Western Washington recently attacked by a cougar, but, you know, it can happen with bears as well. And I have a friend who's a trail runner, lives north of Missoula, and she was telling me, you know, she was on one of her trail runs and ran right into a mama bear and her cub. And it's like, what do you do? Because I know if you run or flee, that triggers a predatory instinct, doesn't it?
Yeah. So running and cycling in bear country are just more inherently risky activities. And I love both of those activities as well. So I'm not going to tell you not to do them, but you need to be safe when you're out there in bear country, lion country, because moving fast can trigger predatory animals to see you as prey, even if they normally would not see people that way. So the best things to do are for running and biking to make a lot of noise, so that they know you're coming. Especially cycling, you're moving so fast, you're covering ground quickly, and you may not be giving the bears in particular enough warning that you're coming down the trail. So loud noise, you know, shouting out, "Hey bear," or whatever every once in a while, especially if the vegetation is thick. And then have your bear spray handy. And for running, I like to carry it in a pocket on my running vest or on a belt. And then for cycling, I like to carry it on the shoulder strap of my hydration pack. And I may keep one on the bike as well, but the thing is with cycling is a lot of folks that we've seen who've had encounters with bears while they're on a bicycle, they get knocked off or they fall off their bike. So you want to have one that's a bear spray can that's on your person, not just on the bike, in case you get separated from your bike.
That's Danielle Euler, folks, with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, who's got some great advice for staying safe in bear country. So I hope you will heed it. Whether you live in bear country and you need to bear-proof your home and your acreage, or whether you're biking or fishing or camping in bear country, very good advice to heed here. Danielle, thanks for sharing all this with us today on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Thanks for having me, John.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter, full of the gear you need to succeed this hunting season. Firearms, ammo, archery equipment, decoys, clothing, boots, and more. Find a location near you or shop online today at sportsmans.com.
You're back in with Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. Our next stop is one of the most beautiful places in the Northwest, Mount Rainier National Park. You might say it's being loved to death. That's why the National Park Service is requiring reservations if you're going to visit between the hours of 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. during the month of July. With us here to explain more about this is Terry Wilde. She's a public affairs officer for the National Park Service there. Terry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate the invitation.
How much of a problem has this become with just having a no reservation situation? How long were people having to wait during the month of July to get in?
That's a great question. We do have about 70% of the park's visitation occurring from July through September. And much of that is on, understandably, really nice summer weekends. We have those glorious long days in the Pacific Northwest, and folks understandably want to get out and enjoy them. But a lot of folks want to get out and enjoy them at about the same time. And so what that can lead to is it can lead to a negative visitor experience in that there could be waiting at the entrance station to come in, sometimes for as long as 2 hours. That's not obviously a fun experience for visitors. They would much rather be able to get in the park when they plan to and spend that time enjoying the park instead of sitting in their car.
I completely understand. And, you know, Mount Rainier is known for its meadows full of wildflowers. I presume July is prime time to see them?
Yeah, July is usually a great time to see them. Of course, peak wildflower season varies a little bit from year to year depending on the weather. But yeah, July is pretty consistently time that we see a really good wildflower season. That can also go into August, you know, early part of August, depending on weather. But the park is known for its wildflowers at the high alpine levels, and that's it's glorious. You know, it's something that folks enjoy spending time in. It's beautiful, take photos, hike in those areas. It's really fantastic.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the fact that this kind of removes the spontaneity for a lot of people who want to visit the park. But on the other hand, you can still get in after 3 o'clock, can't you?
You can. We realize that some folks really want to plan ahead. We do have folks come from all over the country and internationally. And so for a certain portion of the audience, they really want to make sure that, you know, when they arrive at the park, that they're able to come in. They're traveling to do that. For other folks, for a variety of reasons, weather, work schedules, children, school, you know, they may have fewer options and they need to be able to have a more spontaneous option. Fortunately, we have both. We have options for the planners, and we have options for the folks that want to visit spontaneously. So if you are one of those people and you want to visit spontaneously, you just wake up and it's a great day, here are some things you can do. You can come into the park before 7 a.m. You can come into the park after 3 p.m. without a timed entry reservation.
Gotcha.
And that is seven days a week. The other option for folks who prefer the spontaneous, you know, event, that we will also release a number of reservations at 7 p.m. the night before. So let's say that you wake up and, you know, the next day looks fabulous and you have time off and you'd like to go. And you say, I want to go. Well, at 7 o'clock, there's going to be another batch of reservations released. So you can grab a reservation that night for between 7 and 3 and then head into the park the next day.
Okay, that's fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about those people who have probably a year ago, in some cases, booked a stay at the Inn at Longmire or Paradise Inn. Do they also have to make reservations, or reservations included with their booking?
Reservations are included with their booking. So if you have a special use permit, if you are staying in the park at the Paradise Inn or National Park Inn, if you have a backpacking permit, you know, those are things that you do not have to get a special timed entry reservation for. You're staying at the lodge, you're already covered. You don't need to double up on your reservation with that.
So I'm assuming that there's a finite number of reservations you're going to take every day, which begs the question, do people need to act sooner than later to make these reservations or risk not being able to reserve on the day they want to go?
Great question. We are seeing reservation trends that are about what we would expect. So if folks are looking to visit on a weekend in the summer, they are probably best served by trying to get those reservations as soon as they become available. And what I mean by that is, for example, on April 1st, we released the block of reservations that are available for July. And we have seen, at this point in time, as of today, there is only one day that is sold out between that 7 and 3 time period. But those July dates are going a lot faster than the June dates, which is about what we would expect, right? Because folks are generally more available. July is a popular month. So as soon as folks know that they might want to come on a particular day, I would suggest that they go ahead and make a reservation for that time period and also be aware of when those reservations are released. For example, we just released July. The next month we'll release is August 1st through September 2nd, and that will be those reservations will be released at 8 a.m. on May 1st. So if you're thinking about August, try to get online May 1st or somewhere thereby close, you know, to do those. But as of today, there are still reservations available for Paradise and Sunrise, with the exception of just one day in Sunrise that's already full up.
All right. So the Paradise and Sunrise entrances are going to need reservations for July and August. As Terry mentioned, there are some options for those of you who are spontaneous to get some last-minute reservations or to just show up prior to 7 a.m. or after 3 p.m. But here's another question for you. There's more than just the two entrances into the park. I know these are the most popular ones, but isn't there at least one other entrance into the park?
Yeah, you're correct. There are other places that folks can enjoy that are outside of the timed entry reservation corridors. For example, in the northwest corner of the park is the Carbon River area. And so that area includes Carbon River itself. It includes Mowich and the campground up there. And so folks do not need a timed entry reservation to visit that site. Also, folks who are might just be wanting to travel through the park and enjoy places like Tipsu Lake or Ohanapakosh, those areas are also outside of the timed entry reservation corridor. So folks can enjoy those places without making a timed entry reservation. I will note for all visitors, whether you're thinking about making a timed entry reservation or not, that park entrance fees still apply. So your entrance fee gets you into the park for up to 7 days. The timed entry reservation, that $2 fee, that actually goes to recreation.gov staff, because they are the ones that are you physically inputting and creating those reservations. So that $2 is for the reservation. The entrance fee for the park remains the same, and that is good for 7 days.
All right. Thanks for the clarification. Let's wrap things up by telling people what website they should go to and if there's a phone number they can call.
Right. So if folks would like to make a timed entry reservation, they would go not to the park's website, but in this case, they would go to recreation.gov. Folks can also call recreation.gov to make a reservation through the phone if they would prefer. And that number is 877-444-6777. And they can call that number between the hours of 7 and 9 Pacific time, and they'll find somebody there to be able to make a reservation. If folks are looking for park information, so Mount Rainier National Park information, including our information on timed entry, our frequently asked questions list, they can go direct to the National Park website, which is NPS, for National Park Service, so nps.gov/MORA.
That website for Mount Rainier National Park, nps.gov/MORA. If you want to make a reservation, You go to recreation.gov, that's recreation.gov, and you can also call them during business hours at 877-444-6777. So make plans to visit Mount Rainier National Park in maybe a little bit different way than you have in the past, but still make plans to visit. It is truly a jewel here in the Northwest. Terry, thanks so much for sharing this with us today on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Thank you so much, John, for the invitation, for asking great questions, and we really hope that your audience will have a chance to come out and see the park this summer.
Located in the northeast corner of Oregon, Wallowa County offers a unique destination rich in natural beauty and outdoors recreation. Enjoy the clear waters of Wallowa Lake. Take a tram to the top of Mount Howard for million-dollar views. Hike or ride into the Eagle Cap Wilderness and fish or raft the Wallowa and Grand Ronde Rivers. It's all waiting for you in beautiful Wallowa County. Plan your visit today at WallowaCountyChamber.com. That's WallowaCountyChamber.com.
Go fishing. Help salmon and make money. You can do it through September 30th by catching northern pike minnow and turning them in for cash. Here's how it works. First, register at a designated station on the Columbia or Snake River. Then, go fishing. At the end of the day, turn in any pike minnow you catch 9 inches or longer and look for the ones with tags worth $500. You'll get vouchers for those pike minnow you turn in, and you mail those in for cash. Find out more at pikeminnow.org.
Come to Northeast Montana's Missouri River Country for an outdoors adventure. We offer unparalleled wildlife watching at our expansive wildlife refuges. Check out our dinosaur museums and our charming small towns, or revitalize your body with a stay at Sleeping Buffalo Hot Springs. You can kayak or canoe our lakes and rivers, or hike our trails. At night, go stargazing where light pollution won't spoil your view. Find out more at MissouriRiverMT.com.
Western Bass Anglers, time is running out to sign up for the Limit Out Marine Pro-Am and Big Bass tournaments coming up really soon. The deadline is April 21st to register for the Pro-Am, taking place April 25th and 26th at Potholes Reservoir in eastern Washington. The winner of this event, if we get 100 boats, will win a brand new Phoenix Bass boat worth $50,000, and the amateur can win a $5,000 paycheck. Meanwhile, the Big Bass Contest, if we have 100 boats, on May 4th and 5th at Potholes, the biggest bass will be worth $10,000, and there's hourly cash prizes too for the biggest bass weighed in every hour. Find out more and register today at BigBassTrail.com. We'll see you there.
This year, resolve to immerse yourself into the great outdoors. Whether you're learning to hunt, fish, hike, camp, paddle, or grill, or are looking to take yourself to the next level, the place to go for the gear you need is Sportsman's Warehouse. With over 145 stores around the nation, Sportsman's Warehouse is truly America's premier outfitter. Find a store near you or shop online anytime at sportsmans.com. That's sportsmans.com for Sportsman's Warehouse.
Before we go today, we've got time for one last shot of Northwestern Outdoors Radio with your host, John Cruz.
I'm glad you're back, because once again, it's time for your Sportsman's Warehouse Trivia Question of the Week. Now, a lot of you know from previous trivia questions that the first national park established in the United States was Yellowstone National Park. But what was the first national park established in Canada? I'll give you a couple hints. It was established in 1885, and it's located in Western Canada, not too far of a drive from many of us in Washington, Idaho, or Montana. If you know the answer, you know what to do. Simply go to our website at northwesternoutdoors.com and shoot us an answer through our Contact Us page, or you can shoot me an email directly at John, J-O-H-N, at northwesternoutdoors.com, and let me know the name of Canada's first national park. One lucky person who guesses right will win a $25 gift card from America's premier outfitter. That would be Sportsman's Warehouse, with plenty of hiking boots and other hiking gear that'll come in handy should you decide to explore this jewel of Canada.
As we wrap up the show, I would like to ask for some feedback about our new segment, Bird Note, that we have at the beginning of the show. I've had a couple people say they really like it. I personally like it, too. But let me know what you think, and let me know how you think we can help them out in terms of giving them some money to help promote Bird Note. I'm not sure whether we should maybe have a PSA asking people to donate directly or try to hunt up a sponsor for them, but I'd love your ideas on this topic. And if you want to find out more about Bird Note, simply go to birdnote.org. Until next time, do take care, God bless, and make it a point to spend some time outdoors.